I was so insecure before I went to make that movie that I was like, I need to wear glasses just so that they think that I'm smart enough to make a movie. Like, that's where I was. Here I am. I'm going to have 200 people working for me. I don't want them to see me as just this like TV hunk guy. They're never going to trust me.
Welcome to Imposters, the show where I talk to world-class execs, athletes, and entertainers about their personal challenges and how overcoming those challenges has shaped their careers and lives for the better. I'm your host, Alex Lieberman, co-founder and executive chairman of Morning Brew. My guest today is Justin Baldoni. Justin is an actor, producer, filmmaker, and author. A few years ago, he might have been best known as the shirtless hunk on shows like Jane the Virgin, but these days he's better known for his work on changing the conversation around masculinity. In 2017, Justin gave a TED Talk on the topic that has since garnered over 8 million views. He's also written a book called Man Enough, Undefining My Masculinity, which is one of my personal favorite reads of this year, and is set to come out with another book later this year called Boys Will Be Human. Today, Justin leads his own production company called Wayfarer Studios and is also co-hosting the Man Enough podcast with journalist Liz Plank, who we also spoke to on Imposters. But before Justin got to where he is today, he struggled a lot with trying to understand where he fit in the definition of masculinity. And as he tells me in our conversation, he has also had some deep-rooted battles with imposter syndrome. My full conversation with Justin Baldoni right after this quick break.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
So right before this interview, I was watching your TED Talk, because as I tend to push things back and procrastinate,
some last minute prep.
Yeah. Right before you joined, I don't know if you heard the printer. That was the printer that was printing out the notes for this episode. But so I was watching the TED Talk, which, you know, at this point has accumulated 3 million views. And there was a line that stuck out to me that you said in the very beginning. And that line was, I've been pretending to be a man I am not my entire life. So my very simple question for you is, who have you been pretending to be and who are you really?
Well, depends on what situation I'm in or I have been in throughout my life. I've been pretending to be a lot of different men. I think that I put on different masks or different plates of armor, depending on what situation we're in. So without a doubt, I was a different guy when I was, you know, in the locker room with my buddies playing soccer or running track or basketball or working out than I was when I was with a group of women in my 20s. I was different in business meetings when I was younger and more inexperienced and felt like I had to compensate more than I was in my home life with my family and with my parents. I kind of feel like I had a different mask for every situation, because we get so many conflicting messages of what it means to be a man. This idea of like, be true to yourself, or like, what does that even mean? Like, especially when us men are not taught to actually get to know ourselves. How does one be true to himself when we aren't willing to do the actual work of getting to know who we really are? So who am I really? I'm honestly, without a doubt, confidently okay saying I'm still meeting him and figuring that out. I feel like I am closer to understanding and knowing myself than I've ever been. But what I've also learned is that every day I discover something new. And I'm finding I'm finding all these new things about myself that I love. And I'm kind of reintroducing myself to myself now at 38 years old.
What's something you recently discovered about yourself that had you kind of being like, oh, wow, didn't realize that in the 38 years of living?
I discovered I swing a little bit more on the introverted side. for years and years and years, I thought I was an extrovert. And the deeper I've gone into my own healing journey, the more I've realized that, oh, wow, solitude feels good. And it could also be a byproduct of where I am today. I anticipate that that might change in the future. The way I kind of see it is I'm right now, I'm in the back pull of a bow and arrow shot. And I'm pulling back so that I can fly forward. And I mean, that's how I look at a lot of things, like meditation is an example, and prayer. It's the back part of that bow and arrow shot. It's the back swing that gives us the power, right? And our baseball swing or our golf swing. And that's kind of where I'm sitting right now in my emotional and spiritual life. And I've realized like, oh, wow, I don't really want to be around a lot of people. So I also realized that I'm much more of an empath than I thought that I was, which has its complications. Being willing to admit how sensitive I am is not an easy thing for a man, but yet is one of the most beautiful gifts that I could ever have as a human, to be able to feel what somebody else feels, to care that much.
Well, just speaking about being an empath for a second, you know, something that you said in your book was this idea of and I'm paraphrasing it, but basically, can you be a good CEO and entrepreneur while being empathetic and compassionate? Where have you netted out on that answer?
I've netted out on, I don't think you can be a good CEO or a leader without being empathetic and compassionate. So I'm pretty definitive on that line. I mean, they don't really teach you that in business school. You don't learn that.
They definitely do not.
I feel like if you look around at the reason why so many companies fail and why so many leaders, specifically men, fail, it's that we miss the human element of business. Like, it's all driven by the bottom line. And we forget that we have human beings with families that are working with us and for us. And we have a moral duty and an obligation to take care of them and protect them and create an environment where they feel safe. And that's a very challenging thing to do. Some of the hardest times of my life in the last few years have been from really struggling at that intersection of commerce and humanity, of capitalism and the well-being of the mental health of not just myself and my family, but the people that work for me. It looks like sometimes having to make choices that at first may hurt your business if the metric by which you are measuring your business is solely the bottom line. It's a really hard thing to do with the added pressure of needing to be successful and needing to make money, right? So that has been really a challenge for me especially. And I haven't figured it out by any means. But what I can say is any time and every time I have made the unpopular choice to care about a person over the interests of my company, it's always netted out positive.
It's interesting when you call out what you've learned about yourself recently, right? The first thing you said is you're more of an introvert than you may have thought. And the second thing is you're more of an empath than you realize. But it's interesting because when I study your story, when I read your book, it seems like you have an awareness of being someone who is extremely sensitive very early on in their life. Like, at least the way that I read your description of you as a boy is someone who was so incredibly sensitive.
Yeah, but I hated that about myself, Alex.
Tell me more.
Well, the late Bell Hooks says that the first act of violence that men commit in a patriarchal society is not violence against women. It's violence against themselves. And that all men at some point in their lives as young boys engage in what she calls an act of soul murder, where we essentially kill off the sensitive parts of ourselves to be able to survive. Because those sensitive parts of ourselves are then used against us, and we have to weed them out, right? Anything weak, because we grow up as boys. I mean, look at our language. Sensitivity is equal to weakness when you're around a bunch of other boys. Who gets picked on? The sensitive one. What is sensitivity? What is weakness? Feminine qualities. So we're teaching ourselves at a very early age two things. One, to despise and almost have this hatred and dislike to anything feminine, which equals women. We don't think about that, but it's true. We are training ourselves at such a young age to not like women. How do we know this? Because we're taught to hate the parts of ourselves that seem like them or that mimic them or that feel like them. You can't have both. So we're coexisting with this language. And so as at an early age, I was inherently sensitive. I felt a lot. And where does a boy who feels a lot fit in with boys who are trained not to? I had a dad who did not drown that out of me. All my friends had dads that drowned that out of them. So I was the odd one out always. So what do I do when my feelings get hurt? I can't cry, because if I cry, then it gets even worse. Then I'm going to be bullied. Then they're going to talk about it with their friends, and they're going to pick on me the next day, and you name it. And it got worse and worse and worse as I grew up. So I had to kill that part of myself. And then we wonder why we're so numb. Why we feel dead inside. Why, like, this, even to pain, like learning that we must like and want pain, as if like that's a rite of passage in some way. Pain is meant to show us that something is wrong. Sure, we need to have the ability to withstand pain, but I can tell you that if you line up all of the women in my life and all of the men, I will tell you without a doubt the feminine have a higher tolerance for pain than the masculine. But yet we deem it a masculine quality. All of it's backwards. All that to say, it was at an early age when I started to numb that out. And I never was fully able to. So I was kind of living in this weird gray zone where I was both feeling everything and pretending not to. And it felt icky and gross, and I never felt like I knew who I was, and people could sense it, because people can sense that stuff, like trying to be more masculine than you are because you're inherently more sensitive. All of that. That was my you know, elementary and middle school years.
In his early years, Justin's internal gender expression was clearly in flux. On the outside, Justin looked and was perceived as a tough, athletic type guy. But internally, he felt a deeper, more sensitive, and more feminine energy. Because of this, Justin says that middle school was the hardest time of his life. And it's the reason why he's coming out with his third book this year, Boys Will Be Human, which is specifically written for middle school boys.
The other interesting part about this, and I want you to tell me about it, is, right, you did feel, I would say, like many boys, like I definitely did in middle school and high school, a great deal of insecurity. And this insecurity probably came from a lot of different places, including you feeling like you weren't acting like yourself. But what's interesting is you talk about in the book both being bullied as well as bullying others. And also you talk about just your feelings of sadness and anger towards yourself after doing the bullying. So just talk about your relationship with bullying growing up.
Well, it's the same cycle, right? It's the addiction cycle. It's the same thing that happens anytime you do something knowing it goes against your own set of morals or values. You know, it's so funny. When I say words like patriarchy, I lose half of the audience because it's triggering in some way, as if like we don't live in a patriarchal society, right? But we do. And the perfect example of that is at the top of that pyramid, no matter where you look, are men who hold the power. And anywhere below that are people trying to get the power. And how do we get power? By dominating and being more powerful than somebody else, literally climbing the ladder. And I believe in the system in which we live, especially for young boys in America, we are taught that we are less than. And the only way to feel confident or more than is to have power or be stronger or better or faster or smarter or something than someone else. You don't want to sit at the bottom. And my personal experience was I was a pretty easy target, which was odd because I was one of the star athletes. I was always the fastest, could jump the highest. Whatever I did, I was there. I was one of the guys. And then as I got into high school, I was big and strong. And yet I was sensitive. So I was still an easy target. And so picking on me, a star athlete, was like a sure way to have somebody else feel great about themselves. And what I found was to self-soothe, the only way that I could feel better about who I was to then exert power over somebody who was lesser than me, weaker than me, more sensitive than me, something. And every time I would do that, I would feel terrible about myself because I knew what that boy was feeling. And I went, wait a second. So these guys that are bullying me, are they hurting as much as I am? Do they actually want to be doing that? Or are they just so removed from their feelings and intuition and sensitivity that they don't even know they feel terrible? Because it doesn't feel good to make somebody else feel bad, but that's not what we're taught growing up. So it becomes a spiral. And I write in the book, like one day I was tied to the soccer goalpost and another day I was tying another boy to the soccer goalpost. And that goalpost is masculinity. That is the performance. Because deep down, and we know data shows that boys are every bit as sensitive as girls. Men are every bit as sensitive as women.
What Justin is saying here is spot on, and I really hope that his message reaches his intended audience of teenage boys. Think of how productive adolescence could be if we stopped equating masculinity with being tough and unfeeling, and instead started associating it with emotional intelligence and compassion. We're going to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we dive into Justin's experience with imposter syndrome and how he's figuring out what it takes for him to feel like he's enough. Well, it's really interesting because, you know, now, as you've said, right, this is a continued path and journey to better understanding yourself. But like, you have done a shit ton of work to understand who little you was.
Doing. It's ongoing.
You are doing. The question I have is, you know, when did this work start? And the reason I ask is, you know, we're talking about the ways that you behaved and you coped and you felt as a middle schooler or high schooler, but I'm wondering, did these show up in later years also as actor on the set? And I want to explore what that looked like.
Sure. I mean, it shows up every day. It showed up before this podcast. I was like, oh man, am I going to have any stories? What am I going to share? Do I have enough stories? Like, what if I go, and it's always there, man. It's always there sitting on my shoulder, just making me doubt myself. And my God, I remember One of the things about me that's so interesting is I dive into things. I always joke that I'm missing the part of my brain that calculates fear. Not in the way that the guy, you know, who climbed El Cap. Like that. I'm not missing that.
Alex Honnold,
the other Alex. But in the sense where like I'm willing to jump out of the plane and try something I've never tried, so long as it's of service to humanity in some way. And a good example of that is when I went to direct my first movie. I had never directed a movie. I'd only directed documentaries. I've been directing these documentaries about people who had been dying of terminal illnesses. And I was making music videos and commercials, but I'd never done a movie, you know, in my late 20s. And when I pitched this film, I really didn't think it would happen. And of course it did. And here I am producing and directing my first film for Lionsgate and CBS Films. And I'll never forget, I was so insecure before I went to make that movie that I was like, I need to wear glasses just so that they think that I'm smart enough to make a movie. Like, that's where I was. Because I had been, you know, for so long, the focus had been on my looks and, you know, being a shirtless guy on the TV show and sexualized in all of those ways. That's how I made a living. And it was never about my talent. And I was like, wow. Here I am. I'm going to have 200 people working for me. I don't want them to see me as just this like TV hunk guy. They're never going to trust me. So I remember like I bought these fake glasses and I was like trying them on. I remember like the morning of like the first day, I was like, I had all these different outfits and I didn't want to like just wear a t-shirt. I didn't want to be too casual. I was like really stressed about the first impression that I would make. Just because I wanted them to think that I was smart, not even taking into account the fact that here I am I've gotten this movie greenlit and off the ground. Clearly, I've demonstrated I can make this film. No, it was, how are they going to see me? Because that's how, that was my experience growing up. That was the same thing. So this stuff follows, it follows you. Anyone who thinks that the trauma that they experience in middle school and high school and college and in their early 20s, like that just goes away is really mistaken, because it shows up everywhere. I mean, I've had that experience on TV shows, acting. I've had that experience in boardrooms. I've had that experience, you know, just overcompensating in general, always just trying to figure out how do I make somebody believe that I actually deserve to be here, which is something that women, especially Black women, experience every single day.
And I assume the answer is yes, but I'm going to ask anyway. You know, by all accounts externally, and this is the irony of the whole thing, you know, you're wildly successful. But if I was to ask you today, do you still experience imposter syndrome in the work that you do?
Yes, of course.
And why do you think that is, given you have these very objective measures of accomplishment, things that you sought out to do and you did them?
You know, it's interesting. I've never thought about this, but I think it comes from that intersection of a patriarchal, you know, capitalistic society that only values you based on your productivity. So if that is what your value is, and you're always needing to be producing, and somebody is always going to be right behind you trying to take your spot, of course you feel like you're not going to be enough, because somebody might be working harder or know a little bit more than you. And if that's how you define your success and your value, then it's only a matter of time before somebody has more value than you. For me, as an example, I didn't go to film school. I didn't study to be a director. I left college midway through my second year to start acting after a breakup. And my dad gave me 1 year. It's like, all right, you have 1 year. You can take 1 year off, because I was in so much pain. I was so depressed. This girl just crushed me, broke my heart. And then acting took off for me in that year. I booked a few movies and TV movies and eventually a TV series, and I was off. So I didn't actually complete a formal education in anything, number one, which is also why I had master imposter syndrome writing a book, let alone 3 books, right? So that's part of it, is I don't have the education in the same way that I believe we value education. I have a very different education. And when I lean on that, when I go into, oh, wait a second, but I've done that and that and that, and I have my 10,000 hours. It just doesn't look like maybe the way someone else's does. That's when I can go there, that's when my imposter syndrome can be dissipated a little bit and it can be alleviated. But when I just measure my success or measure myself by, you know, what somebody else did and what those filmmakers or what those directors have done, then I absolutely have imposter syndrome. So then imposter syndrome in many ways comes from comparison.
What Justin is talking about here is one of the most universal experiences in modern professional life. Some studies estimate that more than 80% of adults experience imposter syndrome in their working lives. But what's interesting and specific about Justin's imposter syndrome is that it's rooted within the pitfalls of masculinity. I know I've certainly felt my fair share of it. I have the fear that while I've built and sold a company, it was all luck. I will never be able to do it again, which gets me asking myself, if I want to build another business, why am I doing it? Does it come from a place of wanting to do it, or me having to prove to myself that I am capable of doing it? But what I wanted to know was, how does Justin fight imposter syndrome today and quiet the voice that constantly is comparing himself with others? How does he instead remain focused on and driven by what makes him feel truly fulfilled and happy? And his answer is largely driven by his Baha'i faith. A quick explainer for those unfamiliar with the Baha'i religion. Practitioners of Baha'i essentially believe there's one God, and that God is some infinite being that we can't comprehend, and that the different religions around the world are simply different chapters of the same book, and they are all leading us towards unity.
Baha'u'llah, who is, we believe, the most recent manifestation of God, says that man should know his own self and what leads him to loftiness or abasement, wealth or honor. And, you know, really getting to know our own selves is a highly uncomfortable thing to do, because you can't get to know yourself with the noise of the outside world. So what am I doing now? The perfect example is I decided to not direct a movie the last 2 years. I woke up one day, it was COVID. I was finishing my previous movie. I was writing my book. I was essentially shutting down one company and starting a movie studio. I'd raised a bunch of money. Like, I had all of these tentacles out, like an octopus, and all of them were creating. I was, you know, the TED Talks, getting asked to speak at places, you name it. And all of it was creating revenue. I was having to give time to it. I was doing all of these things, and I was doing it while my children were screaming and crying for me in the other room that they wanted daddy, while I was holed up either editing or writing a different chapter of the book. And at one point, my wife says to me, "What is enough?" And I realized that, like, wow, not only did I not feel like I was enough, but because I didn't feel like I was enough, there would never be enough. Because everything that I was doing, despite it being good for the world, and this is where it gets tricky, because I believe that there is truth to all the things that I touch. And if you could look from the carnival of love I started that has helped thousands and thousands of people experiencing homelessness on the street, to my nonprofits and this, everything that I do in some way helps the world and is of service. But is it also so that I can gain love and people will like me and think that I'm a good boy, that I'm a good man, that I'm a good human? Is that also the reason why? And if it is, let's say it's 50-50, because I do believe that there is purity that comes from the work that I do. But the other 50%, well, that means that that's a hole that will never be filled. So I'm going to have to keep going and keep going and keep going. And there'll never be enough money. There'll never be enough people saying, "Oh, you have a beautiful heart. You're doing good in the world," unless I believe it myself. So my wife asked me, "What is enough?" And I didn't have an answer because there wasn't a number.
What did you say in that moment, out of curiosity?
I said, "You're right. There isn't ever going to be enough."
Yeah.
And when you start to look at that, when every one of us human beings starts to look at what is enough for all of us, not just entrepreneurs, but what do we actually need? And when you ask yourself that question, you're able to start to make decisions from a place of true strength and clarity, which is, if I did that movie, if I took that extra job, if I created or wrote that extra book, if I started, as you said, Alex, that other company, why am I really starting it? Do I need the world to see me in a certain way? Is it because I want some recognition? I need more validation? Or is it because I'm measuring my worth based on my productivity? And if I'm not being productive in the way that this group of people, social media, whatever, sees me as productive, then I might not have value. And if I don't have value, what am I doing here? What's the purpose of my life? And then that's when depression, it's all linked together, and it all comes down to what is enough. And I preface it by, entrepreneur wise, my seat is a privileged seat, so I can. But I would argue that all of us have the ability to choose what we want for our lives and what is actually enough.
If you were to ask me, Alex, what is one of the most amazing times in your life? I would say, I don't know, skiing on a mountain or something related to traveling to a really cool place. But at least in your book, you said something very different. I'm going to read a passage and then I want to get your reaction to it. "At 25, I experienced what I would later consider to be one of the most amazing times in my life. I hit rock bottom. I had just gotten dumped by my girlfriend who had left me for a young actor. I had to move out of the apartment we were renting together. I couldn't get an acting job to save my life. I was dropped by my acting manager because the same girlfriend broke ties with her and I was a casualty in the end of their relationship. And I had no money to put down for a first and last on my own place." Why was this an amazing time?
Because I can look back at all of my success today and it points to that moment, because I had to rebuild myself. From that point on, I went on a trip to Haifa, Israel, to visit the Baha'i shrines. I had always wanted to go, and I had a profoundly spiritual experience there. And it was my first time just saying, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm supposed to be. I'm lost. Please guide me. I submit. I'm not in control. Help me find my way and help me be of service in this life. Because I don't know who I am. And I think of it kind of like when a person who struggles with addiction finally goes to AA or gets help and they submit to being powerless over their addiction. And I think that that's what hitting rock bottom does, is you become empty of all of the crap you've been filling yourself with that hasn't really been filling you. So when you hit rock bottom, you kind of reach the bottom of that well, if you will, where you can then start to build up. And so it's an opportunity when you hit rock bottom.
We're going to finish this thing up with a lightning round in a true Man Enough podcast
lightning.
Form.
All right. Let's I'm do terrible this thing. At lightning rounds, but we can try.
Okay. So you're sitting in your kitchen living room area. I don't see a seat next to you, but if there
is a
seat.
This is my tiny house.
Tiny house?
This is the tiny house. Yeah.
Oh, look at this. That's
it's
amazing.
It's literally a tiny house.
Yeah. No, I love tiny houses. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love that. Okay. So in your tiny house, 10-year-old Justin is sitting next to you. What would you say to him right now?
You are enough. Yeah, you are enough. I've thought about that question a lot.
What's something that motivates you that maybe you're not so proud of?
I don't like that I care whether or not people think I'm a good person. And that comes from like mom and faith and just from the time I was a little kid, just wanting to make sure that I was doing good. And I don't like that that's my motivator. And yet at the same time, I'm so grateful that that's my motivator.
What's your biggest insecurity about your business and how do you manage that insecurity?
My biggest insecurity about my business is that I am not a competent leader. And so that would mean that my business insecurity about my business is that it's tied to me. Mm-hmm. And I've often said, I want to create a business where I am dispensable.
Yep.
I don't want to be indispensable in my business. And yet I have to also understand that the reason I was able to raise $100 million is because I am uniquely who I am. So it's that intersection where I'm grappling with like, I'm my company's greatest asset. And I also feel like I'm my company's greatest liability.
Perfect place to finish. Justin Baldoni, thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, thank you, Alex. You're such a sweet, sweet guy. And thank you for what you said before about my book. And thanks for having me. Thanks for doing this podcast.
It was a really powerful experience to talk to someone like Justin, who has done so much inner work over the course of many years to figure out for himself true contentment. And it's even more humbling to hear him constantly admit that despite his ability to sometimes find a way to feel like enough, he still falters. To me, this is an important story to tell because externally, Justin has it all. He's good looking, successful, and exudes confidence, even if sometimes he may be faking it. But even someone like him sometimes experiences imposter syndrome and doubts his own adequacy. And if someone like him can feel this way, I think it's a strong indicator that our own feelings of imposter syndrome are very likely unfounded, and they should absolutely not stop us from pushing forward on what we care about. Imposters is a production of Morning Brew. Our show is produced by Michaela Heck and Vishnu Vallabhaneni. Our executive producer is Brian Henry. Our booking producer is AB Silver. And our sound engineers are Dan Bauza and Rosemary Minkler. Our video producer is Emily Milliron, and Sarah Singer is our VP of Multimedia. Our theme song is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Original music in this episode is by Rosemary Minkler.